Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Late last year, a six-year-old girl, Dominique Moody, died after being beaten and starved. She weighed just 27 pounds while in the care of her legal guardian. Police and social workers had been called to the child's home dozens of times before her death, but each time, Child Protective Services closed abuse investigations due to insufficient evidence. WBTV did a sweeping investigation of the child's death and the circumstances leading up to it. WSOC-TV also took a... Those and other media investigations led to a bipartisan bill being filed in the General Assembly, the Dominique Moody Safety Act. It would create a child welfare case escalation team operated by the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. That team would become involved in decision-making for children at a regional level when a child has had an extensive history of reports of abuse and neglect. This hour, a closer look at this particular tragedy, the role local media played in uncovering the failure of child protective welfare systems, examine how this bill would change things, and its likelihood of passage. We're joined by two of the reporters who covered this story extensively and whose reporting led us to where we are today. Naomi Cowles is an investigative reporter for WBTV. Hunter Sines reported on this story for WSOC-TV. And Emily Putnam Hornstein is the John A. Tate Distinguished Professor for Children in Need at UNC Chapel Hill. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Good morning.
So, Naomi, I'm going to start with you, Naomi, and let's start at the very beginning with the death of this six-year-old child, Dominique Moody. Unfortunately, children die from abuse and neglect a lot. The news reports it. The world moves on. But not this time. What was it about this death that led your station and others to start digging into the details behind this story?
The circumstances of her death, like you mentioned, children, unfortunately, do die from abuse and neglect all the time. This, to me, was an extreme case. There's only one. I've been in reporting for almost 10 years now. There's only one other similar case from a different state I cover that, to me, even came close to the really dark circumstances that investigators outlined in court records. So, you know, we have three women charged with murder in this case. And in those court records for those criminal cases, I reviewed details that, frankly, were just, they are shocking. They keep you up at night. They are things like, I don't know how much we want to get into that, but I'm just going to lightly touch on issues like her mouth was duct taped, her body was bound. There were injuries on her body that clearly dated back months, if not years. She was made to sleep on the floor. I could go on, but again, the circumstances were very dark. And when she died on December 16th and in the weeks after, as we learned some of these details, I was going into Christmas break, which is typically a slower time for me on the Investigates team at WBTV. And it's also a time where I try to review cases that we might be missing, right? And I was looking at some of the daily coverage of this case, looking at some of these details, and the question that I could not get away from was, someone had to have known about this house before this little girl died. It seemed impossible. So many people have said, now you just look at the exterior of this house, and just the exterior alone should have raised red flags. And so when I saw all this daily reporting, that to me was the trigger I needed to start determining, what do I need to do to find the paper trail? And that's where I started.
Hunter, your station too became deeply involved in this, and Dominique, as we've said, was in the care of a legal guardian. Who was that guardian, and what ultimately led to that child's death?
So the legal guardian, first off, it took some time to navigate even through the court records of who of the three who were charged had the guardianship, and come to the result of, it was a woman by the name of Tanya McKnight who had the legal guardianship of little Dominique. How she died, Mike, and I just want to warn your listeners, this is an awful circumstance, but on December 16th, around 7:40 in the morning, CMPD gets a call from Tanya McKnight, Dominique's guardian, saying that her daughter, how she said it, was not breathing. And 2 hours roughly later, at Novant, she is pronounced dead. When you look at all the circumstances, I don't have the medical examiner's report in front of me, but when you look at all the circumstances, I mean, this girl weighed 27 pounds at 6 years old, which is roughly around 13 to 15 pounds less than what a 6-year-old should be weighing. At times, she was put in a dog cage and held there and starved, I would say. And when she was found not breathing, Tanya McKnight had told police that her way of trying to bring her back to life was setting her in front of the oven to try to warm her up. Because you have to remember, this was December, it was winter, it was cold. There was no central heating in the house. There were feces and rats in the house, to what Naomi had mentioned. Nobody should have been living there, yet alone a
Right.
child.
And she was in the care of a legal guardian, but yet three women were charged, Naomi, in this. What was their relationship, the other two, to this child?
One of the others charged appears, correct me if I'm wrong, Hunter, to be the daughter of Tanya McKnight. The other one, Sue Robinson, is, to me, if the relationship is unclear. Again, Hunter, jump in if I'm misremembering here, but it's somewhat unclear, tenuous relationship to the family. And I should note here, there were other children in the house, right? Dominique, as I uncovered later, had a younger sister. There were other children that we know of referenced in court records who were not all related to each other. So there were a lot of people in this house, and it appears to have been a lot, potentially a mixed family.
And you mentioned, Hunter, that she weighed 27 pounds at the time of her death. She was 6 years old. A 5-month-old baby can weigh 14 pounds, and the average 6-year-old weighs between 42 and 45 pounds. So she was severely underweight, and that does not happen overnight. She was in the care of a legal guardian, which tells me, maybe I'm wrong about this, that somebody from social services knew about this situation or knew about this case. And since this doesn't happen overnight, why wasn't this weight loss reported by somebody, family member, neighborhood person, or somebody who maybe checked on them because they're under the care of a legal guardian, somebody from the county?
And I know we're going to get there. And Naomi has done incredible, extensive work on this case, getting some of the stuff that we are going to talk about. The CMPD calls to that house, there were numerous of them. The records from DSS. But I will take this part and let her speak on that of what she found. You can piecemeal this any way you want. First off, you had at least three adults in that house that by North Carolina law should have reported something when you see something. Everyone has an obligation. And so that was the first misstep. And at the beginning, that's what these women were charged with before the first degree murder charges came. They were charged with the failure to report and then multiple misdemeanors and then a felony child abuse and inflicting serious harm before then January came and they were all charged with first degree murder. I'll let Naomi speak to the fact. I mean, that's what I think got us all, including her, of course, of how could this have gone missing?
Yeah, Naomi, I want you to speak to that, but I also, your investigation, as I understand it, uncovered that her circumstances were, in fact, well known to authorities long before she died. You uncovered details of more than or nearly 50 visits from authorities, most of which had not been reported to the public prior to your investigation. So, how many of those visits were focused on Dominique? Or on other problems in the house, or with other children in the house.
So when I started investigating this, I started with the operating theory that a lot of the paper trail here was going to be unavailable to me because most Child Protective Service records in North Carolina and most states, frankly, all states, are rightfully kept private from the public and from reporters and from FOIA requests and FOIA laws because of all that. So I had an operating theory that I wanted to figure out how often police were there and go backwards from there. So there's two types of public records easily available, or not easily, but I could go to. I could go to incident reports, which means something happened that led to an arrest or something that was worth making an incident report for. Or, and what I ended up doing was requesting what's called a CAD report, which means a record of every time someone called police from that address and police were involved, but did not generate an incident report. Now, there were five, I believe, incident reports connected to this home, but what I found was nearly 50 visits from police over the years leading up to Dominique's death. Now, CAD reports don't have a lot of details in them, so I can't tell what every single report was exactly for, but I know a lot of general ideas, right? So a lot of these CAD reports had to do with just disturbances at the home. Some were called in by what appeared to be relatives of the children who were concerned for their welfare, and those really stood out to me. In one case, police were actually hunting for a killer who lived at that home. They were there twice the year before Dominique died. It ended up being an 18-year-old, and he was later charged and sentenced with murder.
The conditions both of you have described, both from her personal treatment and from conditions in the house, would lead one to imagine that if somebody from the outside came in, they would clearly be able to see something here is amiss. Something is not right in this house, and it's also not healthy and in fact could be dangerous. And you look at this child who is severely underweight and has evidence of trauma on her body. Why was there insufficient evidence, Hunter, according to social services, to take up this case and remove that child from that environment?
Mike, I'm going to take my reporter hat off here for a minute and say I still don't know the answer to that question. Because you look at this house just from the outside, if I am anyone with an enforcement type of role driving into the driveway, I would have questions as to why people are even living in that home. Yet alone, if I were to make it up to the door to knock, and even if I wasn't allowed inside, you can't tell me that you can't smell what has been explained in these court documents. So I still cannot wrap my head around the answer to that question of how somebody could not have known something.
In fact, Naomi, Child Protective Services, at least from your reporting, says that they had received five reports alleging children at the home being abused or neglected over 6 years prior to Dominique Moody's death. Even teachers had concerns that they expressed about the hygiene of a younger of another sibling who was in school, because Dominique never went to school, but this other child had evidently poor hygiene for obvious reasons that we've been talking about. When a pattern of neglect, when a pattern of abuse emerges, when people outside the home see it, when Child Protective Services comes in and they witness this, why doesn't this result in some kind of greater scrutiny or, in the end result, a child being removed? Why? What was the failure here? This seems an easy thing to spot.
I think that is the money question. I think that's the question that I've been reporting on this now for what, 4 or 5 months. I don't think there's still a good answer to that question. I think that there's a lot of information yet that has not come out or is not able to be publicly reported yet about what failures happened. But I should say here, what we haven't gotten from the county is answers to that.
And we'll probe that when we come back. And we're also going to bring in Emily Putnam Hornstein, who deals with this on a national basis. This is not an isolated incident. It happens all over the country. We'll find out more about that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte, offering an international curriculum and IB diploma program for high school students designed to help prepare them for college, careers, and a global community. BISCharlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the death of Dominique Moody, a six-year-old child, late last year. And not just because one child died of abuse and neglect, but because this is not an isolated incident. And there are many questions swirling around why local authorities did not step in prior to this child's death, given the length of time that she had to endure the suffering that she clearly endured. And it was uncovered in great detail by both WBTV and WSOC-TV. Naomi Cowles is an investigative reporter at WBTV, and Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Emily Putnam Hornstein's also with us. We're going to bring her into this conversation in a moment. She is the John A. Tate Distinguished Professor for Children in Need at UNC Chapel Hill. Hunter, do we know who made reports to Youth and Family Services that ultimately led to their home visits? Because they came to that house more than once.
They came to that house, and Naomi can correct me if I'm wrong. I believe it was a handful of times, maybe like five times. She had the documents. I know in previous cases, we never were able to get the information of who exactly made reports in previous child neglect cases. I don't know if she was able to get that info.
So I have the juvenile court record that essentially lists out five investigations that CPS conducted into this home. This court record does not include key details, which sources have also told me is alarming. But the details we do know, they do not say who made those reports, but I think we can make an educated guess. Again, if I were to take my reporter hat off, my educated guess is police and teachers, and police, teachers, and extended family.
And Hunter, you spoke with extended members of that family, of Dominique's family, who described her as, quote, always, always, always happy, always smiling, and added that she was loved. Why was she in, I guess, foster care is the best way to describe this, and had they tried to get her back? Were they aware of her physical condition and the conditions of the home in which she was being cared for?
So I spoke online with Dominique's birth mother. Naomi actually interviewed her in person and had a full-blown conversation with her. I spoke in person via Zoom with her biological grandmother and great-grandmother. They had big-time concerns with where she was staying, with the conditions that they saw. They had driven by the home, they told me. They had called police for welfare checks, is what they told me. They could have been part of the 50 calls in the CAD report that Naomi got her hands on. They were trying at some point to get her back, but they were not biological mom who handed her off to Tanya McKnight, who it is my understanding was sort of like a distant relative of the biological mother. So oftentimes you do see this. We've seen it in other cases where a mother gives it to an aunt or uncle through, of course, DSS, but they place them with them before going into an actual foster home type of program.
Emily Putnam Hornstein is with us. Lives Cut Short is a nationwide project for which you, Emily, are the principal investigator. You're also the co-director of the Children's Data Network. And your studies show that around 2,000 infants and children die of mistreatment in this country every year, though the true number is likely higher, and it is uncertain. From 2022 to 2025, 195 children in North Carolina died of abuse and neglect. 70 died in South Carolina in that same period. How does that compare to states of similar-sized populations around the country?
Yeah, we actually started the project because we simply do not have good numbers state to state that would tell us how many children die of abuse and neglect. And as we're talking about Dominique's case, how many children die following significant involvement with Child Protective Services or law enforcement. And there are a few reasons for that. One is that states tend to define what would constitute not just child abuse and neglect, but a fatality due to child abuse and neglect quite differently. States will count the deaths differently for that reason. And so in North Carolina, it's actually really interesting. In 2023, the state reported to the federal government that there were 107 child maltreatment fatalities. In 2024, that number dropped to 46. Now, unless something magical has happened in North Carolina that every other state should be replicating, it is very clear that that has to do with how we counted and the data that were used to construct that number, which, to its credit, the department, the state has acknowledged that that number should not be taken seriously. But when we can't count these very sentinel events, it begs the question, what else are we not responding to properly, not holding our public agencies responsible, and not counting generally?
Are they trying to take steps to change how that count is conducted so that they have more accurate numbers?
Yes, the state has adopted a new case management and technology system to support the better counting and reconciliation of those data. But one of the reasons we launched Lives Cut Short was to exert pressure nationally, it's not just North Carolina, on better counting and reporting, but also to try to surface as many of these cases in a way that the public could use the information to advocate for change as possible. In this case, we have terrific reporting from Naomi and Hunter. But as we've heard, it is very, very difficult for reporters to gain access to information that would allow the public to understand what happened. And that's another piece of what we're trying to do with Lives Cut Short, is to really push for legislative changes that would require much more public data being released. And there are some great examples. You have states where every single time a call comes into the hotline that involves a potential abuse or neglect fatality, there has to be a notification to the public, allowing reporters and others to follow up. There are also states where they publicly release information, including the child's name, the circumstances of the death, and all of the previous child welfare and law enforcement contact. North Carolina does not do any of that with what it releases.
Well, you say that neither North Carolina or South Carolina publish notifications of child maltreatment or fatalities, nor do they publish individual case reviews or summaries. And they're not alone in that. Other states similarly don't report. These are children. Why not?
Naomi mentioned that, of course, we keep confidential child protection records. And so there are a lot of federal rules around that, which make total sense. I think that once a child dies, clearly other states have opted to release that information. Listen, I don't think that many people would say that these child fatalities are a needle in the haystack, outliers, that they don't actually tell us where system and policy reforms are required. And so there's a natural inclination on the part of public actors to hold on to that information, even though I actually think that there's tremendous knowledge that can be gained. And I truly believe that with this Dominique case, it is her case, I think, reflects much more systemic problems with how we investigate, share information, and respond to child safety concerns.
Naomi.
And I want to add to what Emily said. Yes, North Carolina lags behind so many states with this. I used to report in Wisconsin where they did that similar proactive public reporting. But I should add here, there is a law in North Carolina that in very limited circumstances that would apply in Dominique's case. County social services have to release certain information about their involvement upon request to the public. And specific to Dominique's case, Mecklenburg County is not doing that. They first even denied that any requirement existed for them to release information. When I presented them with this law and made that request, they denied that request, citing the criminal investigation. But I should say here, this law only applies when there is a criminal investigation. And so transparency here, I think this just underscores, has been a major, major issue.
So does this make this more, I know, Hunter, I'll come to you in a second, but Emily, does this make the fact that it's underreported, the fact that there are laws, probably well-intentioned laws, put in place to protect certain aspects of this that are backfiring against the actual process, is it making it this problem invisible and therefore maybe more widespread than it should be or could be if we were less secretive about it?
I think that the public has very little understanding of how its local child welfare or child protection agency is functioning. So absolutely, as much as the community should also hold its public sector partners accountable, if there's really no data or information that comes out, short of a dogged reporter who really goes after a particular story, then the public is reasonably left to assume that things are functional when they may not be.
Hunter.
I was just going to pick up on we talk about transparency. Our community talks about transparency often. And I can count multiple instances of similar cases in our media market area and in our geographic area that have happened even in. Since 2000. And there seems to be a pattern where they hide behind the privacy laws of not being transparent after a child's death, even if there is a criminal investigation. But then you also have instances, to Naomi's point, where, like in the Erica Parsons case, where that director of that local DSS office actually released the complaints that said exactly what the complaint was, how DSS went, and what they found, whether things were founded or not founded. So it's happened before. So the question I think really needs to be is if it's happened before, why aren't we being transparent now in hopes that change to a possible systemic problem could actually happen?
You mentioned Erica Parsons. There's also the case of Majelic Young, another young child who died. How many of these instances, because this is kind of your beat, how many of these instances do you have to report on over the years?
That's just a few. I mean, we had even, I don't believe if DSS was involved, but we had an 8-month-old that died a couple of weeks ago, allegedly after being shaken by a parent. And so you have, I mean, it happens all the time. We talked at the beginning of the show, the numbers prove that it happens often. It is, I don't have kids yet. But it is still one of the hardest things, I think, to cover. I mean, when you read this stuff, I know, I mean, Naomi saw photos of Dominique. That stuff stays with you. And when you're talking, Mike, you and I have talked about this before. We're talking about a vulnerable part of our community. These kids don't have a voice, they don't have somebody to stand up for them. And so I think the least we could do is try to fight for something to change so that this doesn't, so we don't have another Majelic Young, so we don't have another Dominique Moody.
I mean, Naomi, I did see a photograph of the outside of the house, several photographs of the outside of the house, and I get your point about, maybe it was Hunter's point about driving up to the house, you would know that something is wrong, and it's not just poverty; it's more to it than that. But a distant relative of this child, Dominique Moody, also acted as the funeral director after her death and told you that the system failed and it has blood on its hands. And you obtained these photos of her from the months before and immediately following her death that showed a, quote, deeply scarred and emaciated child clearly in need of immediate intervention, which never came. Where did the photos come from? Had Youth and Family Services seen them? Did they take them? Where did they come from?
I'm going to break that question into a couple parts. The first part, I don't want to reveal where I got the photos from.
Okay.
I reviewed them in confidence and I have not published those photos. I should be clear, but I will talk about what I saw. The photos were timestamped for either July or August of 2025, so either 5 or 6 months before Dominique died. And the way I've described them is, quite frankly, she looked like a child that you would see in a famine area, such as what the pictures we've seen from, say, Gaza. They were horrific photos. In terms of your second part of the question, do we believe that social services saw those photos? I want to be very careful on how I answer that question, and I'm going to take my reporter hat off, but I personally believe that it is likely. I have not been able to confirm that, but I believe it is likely. I want to touch briefly on the funeral services director, because J. Vernon Peterson is his name, and he should get so much credit here. He was Dominique's great uncle. He did not know Dominique existed. He's a very distant relative before she died. family approached him after her death because he owns a funeral home and, well, we need help. We need to bury this child. And he has done so much to help get this issue in front of lawmakers, to get this issue in front of anyone he possibly can. His heart is incredible. We've had multiple conversations. He was one of the first people I interviewed as part of this. I attended Dominique's funeral. And his advocacy for a child he never met has truly moved me in a way that very few cases have moved me in my career.
Emily, this is gruesome and horrific in every aspect. One would hope, your mind wants to say, well, this is an isolated incident. This was terrible, but it only happened once. It only happened here. Is that even remotely true as you go across the country?
Unfortunately, no. And I want to bring up something. It's interesting. It's May. It's actually National Foster Care Awareness Month. And one of the things that has happened culturally across the country in recent years is that there has been a real pressure on our child protection agencies to reduce their interventions with families and to reduce the number of children who are placed in foster care. We see that, again, not just in North Carolina and South Carolina, it's very much a national phenomenon. I think it comes from a very good place, but we frankly never had any real evidence that we were over-intervening or over-placing. And so it does beg the question, why didn't we intervene in Dominique's case, and how many other children are in comparable situations where any reasonable person off the street would walk into a home and say, this is not an acceptable environment for a young child, but somehow or other we've trained our child welfare workforce to look at that and say, this is just poverty, or this is acceptable, or I should not intervene because then I become a part of some oppressive state system.
The state is obviously aware of this, partly because of the reporting of WBTV and WSOC-TV, and we're going to talk about what has resulted as a result of that in the formulation of a bill that's making its way to the General Assembly, the Dominique Moody Safety Act, and more when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the death and the investigation into the death of a six-year-old child who was grossly underweight when she died and clearly neglected and abused, that of Dominique Moody, and the fact that it has resulted in the General Assembly shepherding a bill to increase child protection, whether that will have any impact on this. We're talking with two of the reporters who extensively reported on this. Naomi Coles from WBTV, she's an investigative reporter there, and Hunter Sines, a reporter for WSOC-TV. Emily Putnam Hornstein is with us too. She's the John A. Tate Distinguished Professor for Children in Need at UNC Chapel Hill. Hunter, you reported on a statement made by the State Department of Health and Human Services in which they expressed heartbreak over this incident and added that their organization, quote, takes its responsibility seriously to ensure the health and well-being of children and families in the state. Were they simply unaware of this? I mean, why would they be? It's a Mecklenburg County problem, right?
Well, that's a loaded question. It's a Mecklenburg County problem here locally, but I would hope that under the umbrella system that the state would know about this as well. But yes, it is a Mecklenburg County issue. Whether they knew it before we reached out to them, I don't know. But
do counties have any responsibility, any legal requirements to report incidents like this to the State Department of Health and Human Services? Or do we know?
I do not know that answer. Naomi, you may.
When a death like this occurs, it is my understanding, and I'll say Emily, correct me if I'm wrong here, but these types of deaths do get reported to the state. And my understanding is that the State Health and Human Services Department is mandated to conduct a death review of Dominique's case, of similar cases like this. I don't think that review is done yet.
In February, Marie Cohen, Emily, writing for Your Lives Cut Short project, addressed the Children's Bureau's eagerly awaited Child Maltreatment Report, which is a national report, and it claims that maltreatment reports, victims, and fatalities were down in 2024, which I think is the latest year for which we have figures. It showed a 10% drop in fatalities, but added, this would be great news if it were true. Essentially, she said that federal trend data cannot be trusted, and she included a statement from the North Carolina Department of Social Services as a basis for that assertion. Why can't we trust federal data on this?
We can't trust federal data because, frankly, the feds haven't told the states exactly what they have to count, so states report all sorts of different things when it comes to child maltreatment fatalities, so we just don't have a good number. What I think is actually rather shocking is that over 10 years ago, there was a national commission to eliminate child abuse and neglect fatalities that was convened, had all sorts of expert testimony, and one of their number one recommendations was greater conformity among states and direction around what gets reported, and there's been almost no action on that. So we are still very much where we were a decade plus ago.
You know, years ago, and I've done many programs on this, years ago, spousal abuse was something that hid in the shadows. Police would respond to a call and they would walk away saying, well, it's a family matter. They'll solve it among themselves, until it changed. That has now changed. Is that what's happening here, that authorities are coming and they look at this as an internal problem and they just go away? Is it both a policy and an attitude adjustment that is needed here?
I do want to acknowledge that I truly think there is probably no harder job than that of a child protection worker. We ask our workforce and our systems to both be kind of reactive if there are immediate safety concerns that are identified when we go out to the house, and proactive in assessing that kind of risk of future harm. It's incredibly, incredibly difficult. One of the things I think we have really dropped the ball on is investing in a workforce that has the proper investigatory and assessment skills, so when they go out into these homes, they know what to look for. Now, based on everything that has been reported by Naomi and Hunter, it seems kind of inconceivable that there were not adults who were in this home who should have taken action. And I want to bring up that it's my understanding law enforcement can also take emergency custody of a child and then go to court and involve DSS. I don't think that ever happened in this case. And then certainly there's still a lot that has not emerged as to the quality or nature of our child protection investigations. And I want to surface one other thing that I know has come up, which is I think we also really need to better understand the role that the county and the state played in placing Dominique in this guardianship with her aunt. You know, Hunter, you mentioned, you know, foster care. Like, I still do not understand, was she formally removed and then informally placed through a legal guardianship? Was she formally removed and then we exited her to guardianship as a form of permanency? And I think that's another area where there should be accountability, but also hopefully learnings that occur through this case, and hopefully that will prevent future cases.
Hunter, do either you or Naomi know the answer to those questions?
I do not know the answer. All that the mother had told me was that she could not take care of at the time, it wasn't the right moment for her to have the care of a child. And so she basically was asking around family, and Tanya had said that she would agree to housing her. Now, how they got the state involved, I do not know that information, if it was in a formal capacity or informal.
I'll just add to that, Hunter, the court record that we do have, that the judge signed off on in that guardianship transfer back in 2020 when Dominique was a baby, we do know that Cumberland County Social Services was involved in some capacity. To Emily's point, I think the accountability and transparency of how involved and exactly how that happened is one of the many questions in this case. Mm-hmm.
Transparency keeps coming up in this conversation, and Hunter knows this because we've talked about it on the News Roundup many times, and he's been a participant in that many times, and that is the fact that we seem to have a problem with transparency in this part of the country, and maybe it's everywhere, but it's certainly here. And in February, Naomi, you reported that that Mecklenburg County's top attorneys, which would mean the district attorney's office, were refusing to tell the public about when workers last visited Dominique Moody's home before her death. North Carolina law requires that and other information be made public upon request. You requested it. Has that information been released yet? Why the initial holdback?
It has not been released yet, and I think that's a massive problem. Yes, to your point, the county attorney's office made the decision after consultation with the district attorney's office. I'll talk through very briefly. The district attorney here, he's responsible for prosecuting the murder cases. His argument here is any action he takes, whether it's advisory or not, to contribute to the release of this information we're seeking could impact his murder cases. Do I agree with that analysis? I don't. I do understand where he's coming from. It is the county attorney, however, who made that decision to not release that information. And I'll add again here, it came after first denying that there was any laws that allowed them to release information at all.
And it's not just you, the pesky media, asking for this information. Last month, the North Carolina House Select Committee on Oversight and Reform requested these records from Mecklenburg County's Department of Social Services related to Dominique Moody's death, the guardians charged with her death, and any police responses, along with communications from the Department of Social Services. But a Mecklenburg County judge granted a protective order which prevents CMPD from turning over these files to a House Select Committee. Do you understand that?
I sat in the hearing when a judge made that decision. And I will say here, I have spoken to Representative Alan Chesser. He is one really leading and taking leading this probe. His team was not informed that this hearing was going to happen, by the way. He has told me that on the record. And so essentially the only people in this hearing to argue were against the release of these files, and it was the defense attorneys who are representing these three defendants in the murder cases. Their responsibility is to their client, and they are the only arguments that the judge heard when deciding to block and put a protective order on CMPD releasing these files. And that's where we're at. My understanding from Representative Chesser is that they are pursuing all their legal options from here. And I think we can expect to see very soon some action on the Oversight Committee.
Hunter, Dominique's death has resulted in House Bill 1144 being filed. That is the Dominique Moody Safety Act. It's been introduced in the General Assembly. Who introduced that bill?
I'm going to let Naomi take this because quite frankly, I want to give credit where it's due. She and their investigative team has really just jumped with this story from the beginning, and lawmakers praised her report. So I'm going to let her speak on this one.
Okay.
I appreciate that. But here's where I'm going to say here, and not to make this a mutual admiration society. It was me reading Hunter's story with the family back in December that made me realize there is more to do here. So I'll just leave that there. But yes, five politicians, I should say from all parties, because one of them is unaffiliated. So Democratic, Republican, and then now unaffiliated Representative Carla Cunningham. They have all come together to essentially draft legislation that would take some of that oversight from just a county level. We talked about that earlier. It's the county making these decisions, and essentially create a regional team overseen by the state to make these decisions about child welfare on very complex cases. And from my conversations with sources from across stakeholder input, you could say, this is something that is much needed. Not all states operate like North Carolina does, where there is so much decision-making at a county level. And this bill, should it pass, and there seems to be strong motivation to pass this from, again, a lot of important people in the General Assembly, this would essentially shift some of that responsibility on complex cases like Dominique's and other cases that we've spoken about to the state.
Yeah, this would create an escalation team under the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. I guess they would be informed of a problem and then they would swing into action. Emily, clearly this is intended to provide oversight for local child protective agencies around the state. How many other states have a system like this where the state would step in the, or at least investigate something that has occurred at the local level?
I don't know that off the top of my head. I will say that it is not atypical when you have situations where you have county-run child welfare systems with state administration and oversight that the state would have some kind of audit or quality assurance process. I think what is unique here is that this would be closer to a real-time operationalization of that so that the state and the regional kind of leadership would be getting involved in cases. Now, I think the real challenge is always things can look good on paper. What is the actual implementation of that? And how quickly, if we have a case that needs to be escalated, how quickly is the county identifying that, consulting with regional partners such that appropriate action is being taken to protect children?
This bill has, as we mentioned, bipartisan support. It was designed to, quote, provide independent expert review of high-risk cases, especially those with multiple screened-out reports, chronic neglect, or complex medical needs. And they say this would ensure better documentation, faster intervention, and stronger oversight to prevent these children from falling through the cracks. Well, this child, in this instance, fell through many cracks. Police, Child Protective Services. This is yet another layer of bureaucracy. Is that likely to speed the system up or slow it down? Naomi?
I'll jump in here. I think that remains to be seen. I think what it's important to understand here as well is this isn't being framed as a fix. It's being framed as a step, right? Lawmakers have been very hesitant when I have asked them to frame this as this will prevent another Dominique Moody. And I think to some degree, we can never prevent another Dominique Moody because that is unfortunately the world we live in.
Right.
I think that in terms of this potentially shifting the responsibility to a different team, it will remain to be seen whether this speeds up the process or just introduces another level of, as you mentioned, bureaucracy.
Hunter.
Just to piggyback on that, yes, not preventing another Dominique Moody, but then when you read this bill, I think it is being framed as that step, like Naomi said, because you have to wonder if this bill was before Dominique Moody, would she still have been saved? You know, how many times, like what is the marker for a history of reports or complicating factors? What are the definitions? So I'm eager to understand more as it goes through and how it will be implemented. If passed, what are those benchmarks that would then alert that specific team?
Mecklenburg County Commission Board Chair Mark Jarrell told you, Naomi, back in January that the county would be carefully reviewing all of the policies in the wake of Dominique's death, but that he and others would have to wait for a full investigation to be conducted before speaking further about that case. Do you know if that policy review has been conducted? Has he said anything more about this? Because this was back in January. It's May.
That is, frankly, my interview with Chairman Mark Jarrell was the last on record interaction I have had with county members about this. A lot of it has been me reaching out and they are now no comment. It has been very difficult to get information from them. I do think that there are, because now of this oversight committee probe and because of other ongoing reviews that I think are going to come out soon, I think that to some degree, I will use Representative Carla Cunningham's words, people are scared and they are retreating and they do not want to say much.
I have 30 seconds, Emily. This is an unfair question, but what recommendations do you have for change in 30 seconds?
In 30 seconds, I think North Carolina should be investing in predictive risk modeling, which has shown that it is a much better way to deliver information, whether it's to a worker or a regional team. We need to pass legislation for greater transparency, and we need investments in our workforce.
And you get the last word. Emily Putnam Hornstein is the John A. Tate Distinguished Professor for Children in Need at UNC Chapel Hill and co-director of the Children's Data Network. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Naomi Coles is an investigative reporter at WBTV. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.